you a high performer, obsessed with growth, and looking for an edge? Welcome to Mind Body Peak Performance. Together, we'll discover underground secrets to unlocking the full potential of your mind, body, and spirit. We'll learn from some of the world's leading minds, from ancient wisdom to cutting-edge tools and everything in between. This is your host, Nick Urban. Enjoy the episode. Hey, thanks for tuning in to Mind Body Peak Performance. The next 2 weeks will mark the start of another mini-series, Master These Skills and Your Career, Relationships, and Overall Quality of Life Will All Improve. Our guest this week is a master of reading humans. He'll help you pick up on the subtle verbal and nonverbal cues to look for, so that you can connect with others on a deeper level and lead more effectively. Irvin Nugent, PhD, helps people harness the power of their emotions so they can have deeper connections, make better decisions, and increase their influence. He is an internationally recognized trainer and top-rated keynote speaker, and is one of the few worldwide certified FACS coders who are experts in reading facial emotions. A gifted storyteller, his programs are infused with passion, dynamism, and, of course, his natural Irish humor. He's also the author of the book, Leadership Lessons from the Pub, which we discuss in this episode. Thank you to Irvin for sharing some tips with us that we can use in our daily lives. I, for one, plan on using these in my next Zoom meetings. If you get value from this episode, please leave us a rating and review. That's what helps us get found and how I continue bringing you thought-provoking guests. Okay, without further ado, on to the episode. We're joined today by Irvin Nugent. Irvin is an emotional intelligence expert who helps leaders around the country, around the world, up-level their skills and ability to persuade. Irvin, welcome to the show.
Nick, wonderful to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Let's start off with the usual introduction question for guests. So far today, what have you done for your health and performance? But in your case, we'll add a little flair. And if there's an emotional intelligence exercise you've done, that works too.
Sure. So we're recording early in the mornings, but I've been up now since 5:30. And my morning routine is pretty much the same. And that involves first thing I do is a little bit of stretches right in the bed itself. And then I before I get out of bed, I normally try and formulate an intention for the day. So, you know, what energy do I want to bring? And then I do some meditation. I normally try and fit in 30 minutes of meditation. And when it comes to emotions, it does. I am a believer in what I call check-ins throughout the day. And that's just an emotional check-in. So part of that's the very first thing in the morning, kind of where am I emotionally today? Have I woken up in a what mood am I in this morning? And what energy am I bringing to each task? And then just before I jumped on this call, I have another little check-in. So anytime I have a meeting, I have an emotional check-in and I say, you know, what energy am I bringing to this interview? Am I where I need to be? What adjustments do I need to make?
And then do you record these somewhere and look back through them? Or is it just in the moment you take note and are present with it?
So that normally it's a mental note. I do some journaling as well. It depends on the morning, what my morning's like. I'll do journaling in the morning for a little bit and then journaling in the evening. And that's sometimes then when I'll take notes. But those little check-ins are just more mental. So they are.
I see. And you also mentioned that you meditate for 30 minutes a day. What do you say to people that say that they're too busy? Because you're obviously a busy guy and finding a full 30 minutes to squeeze in might be difficult some days.
So I just say to people, you know, really be honest with yourself and look back on any day in which you're crazy busy, and you will find moments where you are distracted. You'll find moments where your attention has waned. And for me, my meditation practice, one of the things that it is, gifts that it has given me is the ability to focus in the moment. And I would say to them, I think I am more productive during the day because of that meditation. And in a way, I'm able to get more done because of that half hour.
I agree. In my experience, it pays back in spades.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what's your background? How did you get interested in a topic that's now coming into vogue, but wasn't previously as well known?
Oh, that's a great question. I suppose it goes back to, I grew up in Northern Ireland. I grew up in a society, what we call the Troubles, if people remember back probably in their childhood to think, oh yeah, there was those difficulties in Northern Ireland. And I grew up in a society divided that had really broken down. And I think it placed in my heart a desire to be in some way an instrument of healing and to understand why is it that communication breaks down. And so I've always been fascinated by emotions and fascinated by why we do the things we do. And I suppose as I've gone through my career, I've answered that in different ways. The first iteration was I was a Catholic priest for 10 years. And I did very unusual work there. I worked with refugees from civil war. And then I ran a large agency, social service agency. And while I did that, I also started my doctoral research, which was on leadership in times of crisis. And that really then formulated kind of, how do leaders deal with emotions? Because these emotions impact our decision making, they impact how we show up. And so since then, it's really that being the focus of my career. And as I then transitioned into another job, and then I did some further research in emotional intelligence, and now it's kind of my full-time focus in my own company.
We'll talk more about leadership in a second, but there's this notion, at least that I had, that leaders get to where they are because they're successful, but they're also hard on the people underneath them, and they have this like drill sergeant mentality. And then it was a book called How to Win Friends and Influence People that I read and realized that, oh, okay, all these top leaders, they might have appeared that way from the unstudied, but they actually are very like compassionate and empathetic to the people that are helping them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a great observation. Great book as well. Great observation. One of the things that I will do in an exercise in a training sometimes, I'll ask people to think about who's been the most influential leader or mentor in your life and write down some of the qualities that make you say that. And if you just look at the qualities, there was a listener, there was compassionate, just as you said. They drove me, they helped me drive for excellence, So it's not always what we think soft, but it's this caring that just is felt by the other person. And all of that has to do with emotional intelligence. It's about emotional connection. And leadership, it's hard. You can't be a leader without followers. And while you can have the very militaristic, kind of very direct leadership and et cetera, that will work at times. And there's a place for that. There's a place when you want a more direct leadership in times of crisis at times. But ultimately, emotional intelligence is what is going to move people and make people more productive and have you be a memorable person.
Even in those times of crisis, if you have that emotional intelligence, you can look back on it afterwards and say, hey, I might have come off a little harsh, and then both parties feel better about it afterward anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah. And even in the midst of that, an emotional intelligent person will know that some people need kind of the more direct, but then some people, even in the midst of that, might need a little, caring, concern, et cetera. So it is this leadership is not just one technique. Leadership is this ability to adjust and to be present in the moment for what's needed and then to leverage that.
Let's rewind now a little bit, because we've mentioned emotional intelligence a number of times, and I guess can you define it so we're all on the same page about what it means?
Yeah, one of the ways I just like to define it is just to really talk about what it is. And there are four things when it comes to emotional intelligence. An emotionally intelligent person is doing four things well. Number one, they are self-aware. They know what they are feeling in the moment. They're in touch with their bodies. And because very often our physical bodies give us signs of what emotions we're in, they know their triggers. The second thing is they're able to manage them. So they have a toolkit whenever they're in the midst of an emotion of what tool to use to regulate that emotion so that it shows up appropriately. The third thing is they can notice emotion in others, and they have empathy skills to connect with others. And then finally, they put all that together and they're able to manage a relationship to the best outcome in the situation.
What percent of communication is actually verbal and the rest is body language, tone, a lot of subtle undercurrents?
So yeah, this is an interesting, you're referring to kind of a study, and unfortunately it's kind of out there, but it's a little misused. So the statistic is, you know, that only like you say, it's 9% is verbal, but the specific study that was with a professor from UCLA, Albert Mehrabian, and it was specifically about very emotional communication. So in general communication, it's verbal, of course, is important. What we can say, you know, it's hard to measure something that directly, but at least 50% of all communication is nonverbal. And even when we use our voice, there's nonverbal tones there, and how we use our voice as well. And the flow of our voice is important. So it is, there's a language we are speaking apart from just the words we are using.
Uh-huh. And what does someone get out of working on their EQ? Because when I go to the gym and lift weights, I can see my body change. When I work on different cognition exercises, I feel mentally sharper and clear. Mm-hmm. What about emotional intelligence?
There's no such thing as living without emotions. Emotions are an integral part to everything we do in our lives. I work with clients and say, look, can we just be logical and leave out the emotions? And I said, you know, that's fine if you want to do that and try and do it, but it's not the way we're made as human beings. It's impossible. So people who work on their emotional intelligence, I would say, are first of all, they're able, they have a dexterity to be able to appreciate their emotional life. They're not overwhelmed by emotions. They're able to skillfully use those emotions to make better decisions, to create better relationships. And ultimately, you know, we don't live in an island, so we live with different relationships. So the ultimate benefit is we have healthier relationships and we are happier as human beings.
It wasn't long ago that I identified as that first group that tunes out emotions, thinks they're unnecessary and a way of detracting from the logical side of things. And then I started realizing that that's incomplete. There's more going on than simple a logic appeal. So what is it that, like, how do you get those people to realize that there is more here and that it warrants discovery?
Well, the first thing is, the clients who would come to me with those questions, normally they tend to have very scientific minds and approaches, which I deeply appreciate. And the approach I take to emotional intelligence is very scientific. And I go into a scientific explanation. Look, this is the way the body works. This is how an emotion happens. Why do we have emotions? We have emotions to protect us. Emotions are important for our welfare. And so by the time we become conscious of an emotion, it already has impacted our body. We're already feeling it in our body. So we have a choice. We can suppress that and pretend it isn't there. And that will work for a while, but ultimately it'll come out in other areas in our lives. And if we're really honest, it's going to come out sometimes in inappropriate ways, or we can see this as a gift. It's a message. So in other words, like, you go to the gym and you work out physically and your body is giving you messages. You know, some days you're working the gym and say, you know what? I can't push this hard because my body's giving me a message, or whatever. Our emotions, the same thing. I'm getting an emotional message now. Say I'm angry. What's that message? What am I angry at? What has really triggered me in this moment? And that's information as well to use.
I know that when I get into arguments with my girlfriend, at the time it feels justified, and then I go back and replay the tapes, and when I think about why am I reacting this way, I realize there's something underneath that. And sure, it might be logical in the moment, but there's like an emotional underpinning that makes me react, or that made me react in that way.
Absolutely. And let's face it, there's two things that are just there. One is we're great as human beings of justifying ourselves in the moment. And then upon reflection, we think, is a little bit deeper there. But very often when emotions, it is kind of a playback. You know, initially when we're becoming more aware of our emotions, it is, say, you have an argument with someone, your girlfriend, with boyfriend, whatever, and then you look back and you go, yeah, that wasn't my finest moment there. Or there's something deeper. And then it's like, well, what can I learn from that? What was there something that got me into that argument? And then that prepares you to be better skilled in the future.
Let's make this into the conversation that I wish I had a couple of years back when I didn't believe in the importance of emotions. Can you walk through some of the science of affect?
Sure. So what we know is that when emotions are caused, first of all, by a trigger. So there are most emotions have a universal trigger. And when that trigger happens, it impacts us with a physiological reaction. So before we become conscious of an emotion, which is in about half a second, before that's happened, maybe about a quarter of a second, we begin to see the physiological reaction. So take the emotion, say, of anger. What tends to happen is we feel ourselves becoming flushed. We feel our heart beating. Sometimes we have a tension in our muscles. All of that is happening instantaneously before we become aware. And so, and then what happens, of course, it's almost as if the body then goes into what's called an affect program. So in other words, I feel angry. And so therefore we go into a timeline of what happens. And eventually what happens, of course, is that we choose behaviors or behaviors happen. And what we're looking for is sometimes those behaviors are more reactive than reflective. Mm-hmm. And so what we want to try and do is cause a little space there where we can insert some choice into how we react so that we're not just becoming very reactive in what we say. And that's really, you know, kind of a learning. It's not something we get perfect every time. And if we show up as hungry or tired, et cetera, sometimes we're better at it than others.
Well, I have to know, what are some of those things we can do to increase the wedge between an emotionally reactive stimulus and our response?
So there's a few things. One is, first of all, awareness is important. So awareness happens in a few ways. We mentioned meditation this morning. Mindfulness practices are fantastic because part of the mindfulness practice is this ability to be in touch with the nuances of what's happening in our body. So in other words, you know, because very often in our society, you know, we live from the, I would like to say we live from the neck upwards. We're so out of touch with our bodies. And so this ability to be in touch of the different nuances that's happening. And so people, what we find is people who have practices like mindfulness, attention practices are much better able to catch moments of when the body begins to react. And then they're able then to insert, you know, it's like, oh, okay, something's happening here. I need to insert. And this is all happening, you know, very, very quickly. And then I would just say some tools. So tools can include kind of this ability just to check in with yourself, to kind of, you know, before I say anything, you know, to catch yourself. So some people are very good, you know, even in the midst of some anger, to really just catch themselves and almost like sometimes I'll have said to myself, oh, I'm about to say something. I can't say that. And so then just to catch, because I know it's an unreflective moment that's just not going to serve the relationship. Mm-hmm. And then there's, you know, the different, so those different tools of check-in tools, I have a little thing which is called a 7-second reset, which I invite people to do, like even during meetings or something, when you feel you're a little triggered, to first of all, for 1 second, put your feet on the ground. And that physicality is very important because it gets us out of our emotional brain, to breathe in for 3 seconds and to really at that moment kind of notice what's happening in my body. You know, am I engaged? Am I kind of distant? Am I angry or what's the heat in my body? And then to breathe out. And as we breathe out for 3 seconds, just to make adjustments in our posture, et cetera, so that we're then more engaged. So all these different techniques, there's no one perfect one, and everyone's techniques is a little different. And part of that is just the willingness to explore. But fundamental is that initial kind of that body scan, that awareness of, first of all, what's happening in our body. And then secondly, what are our triggers? And do we know our patterns?
I like that. It's combining ancestral medicine of rooting yourself into the ground and then mindfulness of becoming aware of what you're feeling. And
absolutely.
Then breath work too.
Yeah. And all of those are essential. You know, There's nothing at times, you know, people say, well, this is so darn simple. And I said, it is. But what's difficult about it is we don't do it when we need to. We forget to do it. We have to create new habits. We have to create new practices. And I said, you know, this is ancient wisdom, but the problem is we've forgotten how to implement it.
And I know that's the same for me, that once I remember to take inventory of the way I'm feeling, it's easy, but it's that initial, like there's nothing to piggyback it off of. Usually when you establish new habits, you want to have a trigger that you can piggyback it off of, but it's harder in these situations because
the triggering words or actions can differ so much.
Absolutely. And therefore, part of this is the willingness to put some work in being post-reflective. So after something's happened, this willingness to kind of, and that's where you kind of need like a little bit of the journaling, maybe at the end of the day or during the day, et cetera. You know, what just happened there? You know, kind of like, can I identify the trigger? And it's not even the trigger. It's like, well, what was beneath the trigger? Like, what's the value? Because very often what's happening is there's something that we're holding important that has been violated. And if we can get to that, then we're becoming more self-aware, having that knowledge then to treat it. And then, you know, to the extent of possible, if we're going to be in a situation where we think, oh, this could be a real triggering situation, what can I do? And, you know, very often when we say when we've got a difficult conversation, we're all like, how do I start this? These are the words I'm going to use. Like we practice and practice. But what we never practice is what emotions am I going to feel in this conversation? What is going to come up here? What can I expect the other person to be feeling, and what am I going to do? Like if anger or fear or something comes up, how will I manage that? What tool will I go to? And I think that prep work is really valuable.
There's a book called Never Split the Difference by a hostage negotiator. And mm-hmm. he talks about like reading the room and emotions and picking up on your counterparty. And what you just described is exactly that, but it doesn't need to be only in the context of negotiation. If we are about to have a big conversation with anyone,
yeah,
we can plan out, like, imagine how we could possibly feel, like what the conversation would be like, and then when it actually arises, we're best prepared for it.
Absolutely, yes, totally, and it really is helpful because the emotions will be there, and especially in a very heightened. You know, it's very interesting. I have a little exercise in some of the workshops that I do that I'll ask people to simulate an upcoming difficult conversation. And people say, oh, that's just acting. It's just acting. And it is amazing. You know, when you get another person who's acting for the stand-in for the person you're about to have the conversation with, you know, for 30 seconds, it feels awkward. And then you're in there. And of course, all the emotions come up and people go, wow, that was really powerful. So it really is. And that's another thing you can do. You know, if you have a very, you know, say your work situation where you have a very difficult conversation, get a friend, get someone to practice the conversation with you. And not just the words, but again, kind of what emotions are happening within me.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good one. And I can see how after a few seconds, it would no longer feel like acting. And all of a sudden you'd be emotionally, physically thrown into the same situation.
Totally.
So what are the channels of communication? We've talked about tone a little bit. We've talked about body language, obviously the word choice. What else?
Yeah. So, you know, when it comes to communication, of course, what I like to say is communication is data that's coming to us and what we call their different channels, different sources of data. So the primary source is facial expressions. And then we have body language. We have the voice, which includes the tone of the voice. We then have vocal flow, which is the flow of the voice, the flow of the conversation, the words that are used, so verbal content. And then finally, some models will put in psychophysiology. So are we able to see some psychophysiology signs as well in the other person? But those channels of communication are really the data. Now, we have a bias as human beings, and our bias is words. In our society, we put much more impact in words. And that means at times, whenever we're in a conversation with another person, we tend to look more at the mouth because that's where the words come from. And unfortunately, then what happens is, of course, we're missing all this other data that's coming at us as well.
I can see then in the world of masks and Zoom meetings with the webcam off, if facial expression is the number one, what that would do to, I guess, our relationships.
Yeah. However, even with masks, there are many emotions that are, the identifier is around the eyes. So like sadness, genuine happiness, fear, anger, all of that is in the eyes as well. Some disgust. So even with masks on, you're able to identify, you know, some of the emotions that are being felt as well. But it is disorienting. You know, people are like, and I think part of the uncomfort with masks is because we focus so much on the mouth, is then having that taken away, it's like, oh, well, what do I do now?
Where to look now?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So we're recording this on Zoom right now. What tips do you have for people that use Zoom every single day to improve their Zoom ability, if you will?
Zoom has been a blessing and also for some a curse now. I would just say, first of all, I've run now into more and more clients who's basically day in, day out. It's Zoom, 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 Zoom with very little breaks. So I would just say that is not a natural way for elite performance. We have to begin to build in breaks between meetings, recharge, because we get that naturally when we're moving from room to room. And we've lost that. And so I always pleading with leaders, you know, please give people breaks between meetings because it's you know, the brain is just not functioning right. And then even though we're virtual, when you think about those channels of communication, I'm seeing face, I'm seeing the face, I'm hearing the voice, I'm hearing the vocal flow, depending on how we set up in Zoom, body language is not as important. Now, however, one tip I would do is our gestures are incredibly important.
The whole speak with the hands.
And we know from research that people who use conversational gestures are understood better. They're perceived as being more competent in what they're saying. And so very often, you know, people, you know, all you see is the bobbing head. Whereas if you can kind of position a camera where you're able to show your gestures, I think that's a really critical point and can really help you as a speaker, as a presenter. One of the other things I would just say about Zoom as well is be prepared as you go on. So often there's nothing more distracting when a person enters a Zoom call and it's like, well, wait a minute, like, and then they're looking for this and they're looking for that and they're totally distracted. And of course you're missing so much important data at the beginning of the meeting. So if you can just be there and be ready and you're looking around at other people, you're kind of gaining some information of what's happening with people on the call, that's important. And then one other trick that I would say is, you know, we've heard the word Zoom fatigue a lot. And I think one of the reasons that is it is unnatural for us as human beings to see ourselves as we speak. It is very distracting. When you're trying to communicate with other people, your eyes are always going back to yourself as you're speaking. And then finally, the final point I would say, sometimes our cam is above where we're looking. And so when we want to make eye contact with a person, it's incredibly important that we're looking at the cam and not at their picture in Zoom. And especially if we're trying to make connection as well, that can be important.
Yeah, I'm waiting for the day where the camera is built into Zoom so you can look right at them. But until
absolutely. Then. Yeah. Yeah. There's a couple of, there's like a company that kind of do a Perspex and that kind of you can bring down the camera, which is kind of more at your eye level. But that's important too.
Oh, cool. I guess now via Zoom or when people go back to working in person, how do they go about reading the room? I guess, first of all, what is reading the room and what's your strategy there?
So reading the room is this ability to, first of all, walk into a room and feel the emotional temperature of the room. Our emotions are contagious. Our emotions are, so we're living in this time of a pandemic where we've got used to this idea of an invisible contagion that we kind of like, whereas we may breathe it. Well, emotions have been doing that since the beginning of time. And we literally catch the emotions of others. And so when you walk into a room, you know, people, you're able to feel something. What is it? So people who are really attuned to looking around and some of this emotional, what I call heaviness or lightness is good language around it is important. So that's what you're looking at. You're also looking at some of the body language. So is the body language, I always like to say, am I seeing people who are comfortable and relaxed and their body language shows that they're comfortable and relaxed? Or am I seeing people who are nervous, who are uptight, who are a little bit defensive, they're not open? So that's important as well. And then we're also then looking at some of the facial expressions. You know, what am I seeing in the face? Am I seeing people who are relaxed or animated? Am I seeing any emotions in people's faces? Am I seeing any micro expressions, which we haven't mentioned yet, but any micro expressions which are, so at times, whenever we're in an emotional episode, sometimes we very clearly want people to know what emotion we're feeling, and sometimes we don't. And when we don't, because emotions are so quick, they leak out. And so we can see some leaked emotions as well around the table.
What do leaked emotions look like?
When a person is angry, what normally what we're seeing is the eyes are brought down. There's kind of like a peering, a staring straight ahead. And what will happen with a micro expression is that will happen. What will happen in half a second or less, because the person then becomes conscious. Oh, I don't want him to know I'm angry. And then they'll kind of go back. Sometimes they'll go into like a social smile to cover it up. But that leakage, you can be trained to find that leakage, and it comes out. And therefore, that again is data that's very important.
So if I set a reminder on my phone to check for, or to read the room, and it goes off twice a day, three times a day, will all of a sudden, if I pay attention to that and carry that into my meetings and I actually apply it after a couple months, it will become more second nature and I'll be able to detect more of these micro expressions or leaked emotions?
Yeah. So I would just say, even like, you know, if you've got, say, a meeting, and if you just put a little alarm like a minute before the meeting, just say, read the room. So in other words, like what you're going to do the first minute in a room is you're just going to have a look around. You're going to look around at what's there. You're going to kind of feel it, et cetera. And I think that can be useful. The micro expressions, absolutely. They're totally trainable. You can be trained to notice them, and then it's like a muscle. Once you practice with it, et cetera, it is there and very easy to recognize.
And what about people that are either not emotionally expressive or they have a different pattern? Like, does it matter that you don't know your counterparty always?
No, it doesn't matter. So sometimes, because what's important there, of course, is a baseline. So in other words, you know, what is, and there's, of course, multiple baselines. There's not just one. But, you know, if you don't know another person, part of what you're doing in the initial conversation, getting to know them, you're kind of getting a reading for them. And part of that will be, well, this person is not very expressive in this context. But still, just because you're not expressive doesn't mean that you're not feeling emotions. Our emotions are there. How we choose to express them may be different, yeah. but yes, and even unexpressive people have micro expressions.
When I first started learning about emotional intelligence, I discovered that there's what are called the universal emotions. What are those?
Yeah. So, you know, it used to be, you know, before the 1960s, basically no one ever studied emotions. And Paul Ekman was one of the first psychologists who really decided that this he would embark on the study of emotions, and of course was absolutely this was unheard of in the world of psychology. And so it used to be thought that all emotions were culturally based and socially based and differed. And so emotion expression wasn't the same from person to person, because we learned our emotions kind of looking at our parents' faces. But what his groundbreaking research found out, actually there are certain what he calls base emotions, which are universal. No matter where you are in the world, they are displayed on the face in the same way. It doesn't matter what gender you are, the age, et cetera, they will be the same. And so those seven universal emotions are surprise and fear and anger and disgust, contempt, happiness, and sadness. That doesn't mean that there aren't any other emotions. There are hundreds or thousands of emotions, but those seven, through research, have shown that they are universal. And that's what makes them unique and different.
And those are displayed the same way across cultures?
No. So then you've got to, well, in the fullness there are. Now, then you've got to add in the layer of how culture interacts. So culture is very important as well when it comes to emotions. So there are certain cultures, say, for example, where it is not appropriate, say, to show anger to other people. And so the message we've got is don't be angry, don't show angry, you know, anger. And what happens then, of course, is what we have, what was called display rules. And so a person in a certain culture where, say, you don't show anger to an elder, if a situation happens, you're angry, you'll suppress that emotion because that culture comes in. So the emotions are always interacting with the display rules as well.
And we know from some of the work of people like Dr. Joe Dispenza, Bruce Lipton, these researchers and doctors, that emotions, you can suppress them, you can keep suppressing them, but they accumulate in the body. And over time, like you were saying, they come out in weird ways. And if they go unresolved for years or decades, can result in some, like, I guess, degeneration of the body and mind.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, this is a whole area of research that we're really beginning to understand. There's some amazing research as well on PTSD and how trauma as well is housed in the body. And, you know, very often when it came to, say, treatment of trauma, it was a psychiatric kind of process. And now what we're understanding as well, there's a whole physical process of that, of working with trauma in the body and working trauma out of the body. So absolutely, it's and again, it's that connection. It's the mind-body connection. And it's so often that we think things are in the mind, you know, and it's not. So often it's in the mind, yes, but it's also in the body. And very often the body as a mode of treatment or a mode of addressing issues can be a wonderful avenue that, say, perhaps the mind is not possible. And I was just looking at some recent research there of some great success in really doing body work and helping with trauma.
Symptoms of problems with either the brain or the body can manifest in the opposite part.
Yep. Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. And I think that any health program that doesn't address emotions over time is inadequate, because that's a huge bedrock of what it is to be fully healthy.
Yep. Oh, absolutely. Our emotional life, I mean, our emotions are there for our welfare. They help us survive. They protect us. They engage us with life. They make, you know, what we know from some research of people with brain damage, and especially when certain parts of the brain, which we know are important for emotional functioning, are damaged. One of the consequences of with that person who's been researched is they have great difficulty establishing and sustaining relationships. So when you just think about it, you know, relationships are the core of our life, and our emotions are a key element in those relationships. And, you know, if our emotional intelligence is poor and our relationships are poor, the quality of our life is impacted in so many different ways.
Say my partner comes to me and it causes me to feel a certain way, and I look back on that moment and realize that there was a emotional trigger point there. How do I go about understanding this and changing my automatic response?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So first of all, kudos on recognizing it. So that's a step. Some people don't even recognize. Some people haven't the insight, first of all, to recognize, well, I was triggered. So the first thing is to notice it, to try then and say, okay, what happened there? And very often then I'll ask, is this the first time that something like this has happened? And then kind of think about, is there a history? Where did this come from? And then what is it? What's the main concern here? Why am I so triggered by this, whatever someone was said or something? And then one exercise that I will do with triggers is visualization. So we know the power of visualization to create new neural pathways, to kind of imagine new behaviors. And so say, for example, I was working with a client who one of the trigger points is for them when they were at a meeting and someone spoke over them. It just shut them down. They became angry and they shut down. They said, kind of mentally, they said, I'm out of here. And so we explored that. And I said, well, is that helpful? No, it's not helpful. And so, you know, as they looked at patterns in their life, they actually said, you know, I can remember as a child at the dining room table, I was told to shush. And you know, so it was interesting, kind of, you know, it's not always goes back to childhood, but sometimes it does. And so there's little messages there. So one of the things that we did is we kind of visualized a different way of responding. And I said, you know, how would you like to respond? And she said to me, no, I would really like to be kind of own my power and be able to say to the person, actually, I haven't finished yet. I'm going to need another minute. And so I told her, can you visualize that? You know, can you see yourself? Can you feel what that's happening? Can, et cetera. And eventually she was able, you know, the good thing about that was that every Wednesday was an opportunity because that person was in the room for a meeting, but she was able to kind of then practice with that and to create a new response and really create a new habit.
I'm a big fan of visualization because when I was playing rugby and football, I learned that it's what a lot of the top teams do. And then I dug into the research and was mind blown. There's studies showing that if you take a group of pianists and another group that doesn't actually have physical access to a piano, and they both practice for 30 minutes a day for a couple of weeks, both novices, then they can actually, when the blindfolded, non-practicing, like only visualizing group is put in front of a piano to actually play, they're equivalent more or less to the group that's been actually practicing on the physical piano for a long time. And then there's another example in athletes where there's two groups. One group is working out, lifting weights. The other is just imagining that, that they're lifting the weights. They're like making their muscles contract with their mind. And they have the same results after the same study period.
Absolutely. And in the other area as well that I work with, well, I do some work with doctors and surgeons, et cetera. It's surgeons use this technique a lot. So surgeons before a big surgery as well will visualize everything during the surgery, what would happen if something goes wrong, et cetera. So its power is immense, you know, and we recognize it kind of in the sports world a lot, but I think it's a gift for so many different areas as well in our life.
Yeah. It's an underutilized tool that we can all use more.
Absolutely. Yes.
So what are you interested in researching these days?
You know, before COVID, because of the world we lived in with its constant change, et cetera, people were very triggered anyway. And here we have this pandemic, which actually is a physical threat. You know, so often what we get worried about really isn't a physical threat. This is kind of, so it's interesting. It's the first time we've had really, you know, kind of a life and death situation. So I'm fascinated about how people have coped through this situation, and it has lasted a long time. And then now as we return to work as well, that is going to create opportunities and challenges as well. What I'm finding is that people who are returning, I don't want things to return the way they were. Because the way they were was out of sync. My work-life balance was out of sync, whatever. It just wasn't. So I'm fascinated by that. I'm fascinated by, you know, kind of what will the workplace look like? How can we create what I like to say is more human workspaces where people are able to belong and thrive? And so I think this is a huge, we're beginning to learn. And I think, you know, in 4 or 5 years, we'll be looking back with some great research as well on how this has impacted. So that's kind of my fascination at the moment.
And when you, I guess your book, Leadership Lessons from the Pub, came out before the pandemic.
No, it actually was in the middle of it. Yep.
Oh, perfect. So what are some of those lessons you weaved into the book?
Yeah. So, I grew up in a pub in Northern Ireland. And as I look at workplaces, what I heard is people are disengaged. And I said, let's go to an institution that's been hundreds of years old where people love to go and they have great conversations, et cetera. So some of the lessons, first of all, is the importance of setting the tone. I think because of emotional contagion, we forget how powerful it is, the emotion that we're bringing to any conversation, and to be able to notice someone else's emotion being brought to us and be able to catch that and say, I don't want to catch that emotion. So that's one that's really important.
How do you tell someone that you don't want to catch their emotion?
Well, you don't say that to them. But I think, you know, part of it is like, if you've got a person, say, just say you're in a space where you've got a person who's incredibly negative. They're just, you know, everything. And I, you know, you stay in that space and it just like, ugh. So the point is, now you don't want to be rude to them, but I think what you want to try and do is to either redirect the conversation or check in with yourself after that conversation, you know, kind of, I may have to kind of blow off some of that negativity and kind of go into some positivity, you know, some gratitude or whatever work to kind of really just make sure that I'm not carrying that with me. The first lesson was, you know, be aware of that tone. The second one as well then is triggers. So importantly then, this, we've kind of talked about this, that the knowledge of knowing where your triggers are and what they are. Third is, I would say, is the importance of story. As you know, kind of in the pub, stories are the lifeblood, and very often as well, you know, there's a wonderful quote, which I love, is it's the universe is not made of atoms, it's made of stories. And story is how we make meaning in the world. And to recognize the power of story, and especially say in a leadership situation as well, you know, you can talk all you want, but if you use a powerful story, which is an example of something that you want to show, people will remember that. The other thing to be careful is we love to make up stories. So when there is a gap in knowledge, We are great story. We make up like, so I didn't get the phone call this morning. Well, we go into like, oh, well, this has happened or that's happened. And of course, there's no data. And I always like to say, you know, if this is a court of law, would there be enough evidence to convict? So what's your evidence? You know, so as natural storytellers, it's a gift, but then also we have to be careful because we love to make up stories. And then one of the other lessons is conflict. And conflict is part of life. And I always like to say, you know, we have a conflict story. Are we aware of our conflict story? And what I mean by that is, how are we aware of how conflict impacts us? And so for some people, we're conflict averse. And so we will avoid conflict at all costs. For others, I'm more comfortable conflict. I can get stuck in. It's okay. So to recognize our own conflict story and to be able then to manage that, because sometimes what's required in a situation is for us to sit back, and for other times it's for us to engage and to know when that moment is.
That discernment takes some time. But yes. I also recently started a storytelling course by Pixar, and I think it's one of those like core life skills that everyone should learn and master.
Absolutely, because you know, why is it we love movies? We love movies because we love stories, and Hollywood does it well, and they have hooked us and they bring us in. And people who can tell stories are highly influential people. We love it, you know. So if you're looking for more influence in your life, learn how to tell stories, because it absolutely attract people are attracted to stories. They're influenced by stories, and they're memorable. They make us memorable as people.
Even though most of them follow the classic hero's journey.
Yes. They're all, again, like this wisdom, this pattern, you know, it's interesting, you know, as you uncover storytelling, you know, because really we were telling stories before we spoke, because we were drawing pictures on cave walls, you know, kind of. So there, it's interesting kind of how stories have a pattern. And, you know, I think all stories need essential ingredients. You know, I just did a video on YouTube recently about that. And I said, you know, if you don't have these ingredients, your story's going to suck. So, you know, you need like the unique kind of great characters, and you need tension. Story thrives on tension. You know, if Star Wars was based on ships going across the universe where there was no conflict and everything was fine and they just went on cruises all over the place, you know, that's just not interesting. So inherently we need tension, and then we need to resolve the tension, which is all part of good storytelling.
I almost wish I never discovered the hero's journey though, because now when I see a movie, I can guess what's coming next pretty much at any point.
It's kind of like the micro expressions. Once you learn it, you know, you can't switch it off, and you see it in people's faces. You know, people always say that, well, like when you're out socially, like don't you switch it off? And I said, no, it's there. You see it. And so you just use it. You know, it's kind of you don't have to point it out in people's faces, but it's data.
Yeah. Well, if people are looking forward to connecting with you, where can they find you in socials, or maybe pick up your expression of the hero's journey in Leadership Lessons from the Pub?
Yeah, sure. My website is one of the best places, irvinnugent.com. There you'll find there's a place for the book. There's some free resources. I have a landing page which has a free emotional intelligence course for people that want to kind of begin to explore that. It's irvinnugent.com/gift. And then YouTube. Every week I have a new video on Wednesday on YouTube, which is an educational video about emotional intelligence in our lives and at work. I'm in the other Facebook, LinkedIn as well. Feel free to join there. But YouTube is really great as well for some content.
Yeah, and all these links will be in the show notes as always. We've got one more question before a rapid fire round.
Okay.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Imagine that there's a worldwide burning of the books. All knowledge on earth is gone. You get to save the works of three teachers. They can be books, podcasts, lessons of any form. Who would you save?
Yeah. Oh God. Decisions here. So first of all, I have to save the seminal work in emotional research, which is Paul Ekman's Emotions Revealed. Which really is an amazing book for people. If you're looking to kind of explore emotions, it is amazing. I think I would have to have a little bit of mystical. So I think I'd either go Rumi or Teilhard de Chardin. Kind of, you know, both of those are amazing. And then I would bring Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. because I think, you know, I think it, at the end of the day, our happiness is about our meaning and our belonging.
I love that. Those are all great choices. Okay, on to the rapid fire round. What's the best or worst advice you've ever received?
The best one, which some people hate, is this too will pass. And I think people who are mindful know that anything we go through is a moment to moment. And to be able to say, you know, no matter what it is, it's passing. It's just this moment. It's passing. It's just this moment. Worst is better be safe than sorry. I know in my world, I think if I look back at my younger self, I would have said, you know, take some more risks. And I think it would have worked better. But so that's kind of the two I would play with.
Growth doesn't come from staying within your comfort zone.
Amen to that. Absolutely.
What's the number one thing you believe that virtually nobody else does?
Oh, when people talk about anger as a bad emotion, and it's so out there. It's so pervasive. And I say, anger is not bad. Anger is information. How you use anger can be destructive, but I hate emotions being classed as good or bad. Emotions are information, nothing more. How we use them can be constructive or destructive, but I hate language of good and bad when it comes to emotions.
Oh, that's a good one. Makes sense. I mean, I, for most of my life, have classified emotions as good or bad until, I guess, today.
Yeah. Yeah. Just, and then it transforms it. It transforms an emotion from like that's a bad emotion. No, it's not. It's just information. What's the information it's giving you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's something that your tribe doesn't know about you?
What's something my tribe doesn't know about me? You kind of triggered a memory as you were talking today about rugby. So I grew up as a rugby player. I went to a school, which was almost in Ireland, which was like rugby was a religion, and it was the only sport that was played practically in the school. So I was a tight head prop, and I played that, and I went to college as well and played some rugby. So yeah, I love rugby. I still sports wise, as even though I've been in the States now 30 years, I still revert back to my childhood. Rugby and football, soccer are kind of the two that I'm passionate about.
Maybe that's where the name for your book actually came from, because of your history with rugby.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh God. Yes. Yes. The post rugby games all tended invariably to end up in the pub, which is a good thing.
That's how it goes. Yeah. Well, how would you like to conclude our journey together today?
I would just say to people, emotions are a superpower. And at times, I think we don't appreciate that. And so to embrace this power within you and to be a learner, I think mindset is just be a learner, be curious about your emotions. And it's the secret sauce to a happy life.
I'm Nick Urban with Irvin Nugent, signing out from mindbodypeak.com. Have a great week. Thank you for tuning in to this episode. Head over to Apple Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts and leave a rating. Every review helps me bring you thought-provoking guests. As always, you can find the show notes for this one at mindbodypeak.com/ and then the number of the episode. There, you can also chat with other peak performers or connect with me directly. The information depicted in this podcast is for information purposes only. Please consult your primary healthcare professional before making any lifestyle changes.